Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the A-List with me, Jennifer Lindsay, on a day with a bit of a bad throat and my husband yelling about the World Cup downstairs. Every week, as you know, we chat with an influencer to see what makes them tick. And this week, we're just now being joined, Friday, June 28, 2010, by Scott Beal, who is the founder and CEO of Atlas Corps. Welcome, Scott.
Good afternoon, Jennifer. How are you?
I'm great, except for my husband, I was just saying, is yelling downstairs about England not doing so well in the World Cup at the moment, or not doing well enough.
Well, at least America tied.
Yeah, he's English, so he's on the other side. So Algeria, so listeners from Algeria, my apologies. I remain neutral. How are you, Scott?
I'm doing great.
Where in the world are you today?
Today I'm in Washington, D.C.
And the reason that I'm asking Scott that is because there's been some exciting developments with Atlas Corps. Actually, lots of different things going on, but one involving a personal cause of mine, which a lot of folks know, I am one of those. I'm a returned Peace Corps volunteer from years ago. So, Scott, why don't you start out by setting the stage for our guests who may not know about Atlas Corps and tell them what it's about and then what you're working on in Washington.
Great. Well, Atlas Corps is a management development program for the best of the world's rising nonprofit leaders. And what we do is we recruit nonprofit leaders from all over the world to volunteer in the United States. And they come and they learn skills and they volunteer at U.S. organizations for about a year and they share their perspectives while also gaining experience. And then after that year or occasionally 18 months, they head back home. And the idea is we're developing a global network of the best of the world's rising leaders working on a wide variety of critical social issues, from the environment to women's development to hunger to health issues, all the global social issues that are out there. When I first developed the idea, this is why returned Peace Corps volunteers like the program so much, I used to call Atlas Corps a reverse Peace Corps. Exactly. But when I once explained it as a reverse Peace Corps to a good friend of mine in India, he said, "I like your idea, but why are you against peace?" So,
yeah, you're definitely not against peace. In fact,
I'm not anti-peace.
Yeah, one of the pieces of the program that I was involved in had a business piece trying to teach, some of the potential entrepreneurs in Turkmenistan language skills to be able to create businesses in these economies that have sort of been set free. So let's talk a little bit about the newest developments around Atlas Corps and some. I don't want to say they're necessarily alliances. I'll let you describe what they are, but you've definitely had some great pairings with some very well-known groups.
Yeah, absolutely. And we just launched our fourth class of fellows about 3 months ago, and while still a lot of people don't know really all about our work, we've really been able to make some great progress in the last 3.5 years. So in this time period, we brought 39 fellows from 12 different countries to volunteer in the U.S. for 1 year, and we do send some Americans abroad. Currently, we're sending Americans to volunteer in Bogota, Colombia. All of our fellows are skilled professionals, so they typically are in their late 20s, early 30s, so they all have a few years of experience, a college degree, English fluency, before they come to the U.S. And when we bring them here, we partner with U.S. nonprofit organizations. So we work with Ashoka, or we've worked in the past with TechnoServe, or the Grameen Foundation's taken a number of our fellows. And it's an exciting partnership because these fellows are able to go to among the world's best nonprofits and learn from their perspectives, but also these U.S. nonprofits are able to gain from the knowledge and skills and experience and ideas that these individuals have overseas.
So it's a real back-and-forth learning, which is very exciting. Now, one thing I'm curious about, as it's a management development organization, and that's kind of at the core, are the folks that are gaining skills really, are they meant to be, are they trained really specifically to go back and create nonprofit organizations in their home countries? Or are they just really gaining experience that you think is great for business overall?
So we have 12 training themes, one each month. And the idea behind these, the skills that we're trying to impart in them, is that they are going to go back and become even better nonprofit leaders. One of the topics that we spent, in fact, a couple months talking about is social entrepreneurship, about how you would start your own nonprofit, how you make your organization sustainable and scalable and really have a large impact and approach ways and innovative ways of addressing social challenges. We don't, however, require that all of our fellows be social entrepreneurs or expect that they'll all go back and start their own nonprofits. Sometimes what the world needs is just people who are, you know, really good managers and really good number twos and really good program, you know, directors within organizations overseas. So a lot of organizations have that focus on always starting something new. We're really focusing on instilling the skills in people that make them more effective at what they do, either in some areas, starting organizations because there's needs that are being unmet, or in other cases, becoming leaders of current organizations and helping them grow and expand.
So what motivated you to start Atlas Corps in the first place?
So I was living in India working for the U.S. State Department, and I was helping manage the U.S. government's efforts to fight human trafficking overseas. And it was an amazing opportunity to live in India, which is a dynamic country, and to
which
serve.
Which part of India were you in?
In New Delhi.
Oh, fantastic.
So 2 years, my wife and I were there, and we loved every day of it. And I was, at the same time, reading Thomas Friedman's The World is Flat and meeting a lot of Ashoka fellows. I used to work at Ashoka in the past, so a lot of social entrepreneurs in India who had started their own nonprofits. And it occurred to me that when you read Friedman, how there's the world is flat when it comes to the private sector, and all these people going from India to, like, for example, go to Seattle. An Indian guy goes to Seattle, he invents Hotmail, he becomes a millionaire, Bill Gates becomes a good billionaire, and we all benefit because we can email each other for free. And there's countless examples of this in the private sector. Academic sector, smartest kids from around the world go to the best universities, they learn skills, they go back home. Even the religious sector, even the government sector, the military sector, all these various sectors of our economy, of our society, is the benefits of globalization. But in the nonprofit sector, for close to 49 years, at the time about 45, Americans have gone to volunteer abroad through organizations and entities like the Peace Corps. And I think the Peace Corps is awesome, and it's one of the most, like, such a proud tradition in the United States. But it doesn't really make sense that we haven't had the same opportunity for people from overseas to come volunteer here. We'll take Indian engineers, but what about Indians working on health issues or women's issues or poverty? You know, we will send a lot of people to South Africa to work on HIV/AIDS, but it would make sense every once in a while for a South African to come here. You know, where I am in Washington, D.C., has a worse HIV/AIDS rate than half the countries in Africa. So there are certainly things that we can learn from each other. And it was a simple, for like the economist in the audience, a simple market failure that the visa was very complicated for the nonprofit sector, for these nonprofit leaders. And the financing was complicated as well. I mean, it's easier for Microsoft to figure out a way to, pay for it all because there's a profit motive than there is for the organization that's addressing malaria. So having worked at the State Department, I knew how to do the visas. It's like the Fulbright visa for when someone comes to come and learn for a year. And having worked at Ashoka, I had some ideas about sustainability. And what we do is we have organizations where we place our fellows, like Oxfam or Grameen or Centronia. They'll pay Atlas Corps about $29,000. And they'll get a leader from overseas for a year. It costs us about $40,000, so we have to fundraise the difference. But it makes it a much more sustainable and cost-effective way of doing international development and exchange.
Yeah, I know that working at the State Department is sort of an accomplishment within itself. Tell us a little bit about your tenure with the State Department, how long you were with the State Department, because, you know, as I said, you know, it is a small world once you go to some of the emerging countries in the world and you start. I know in the case of Turkmenistan, you know, we had a very close relationship with, for example, the ambassador even to Turkmenistan, because it's a State Department employee who's gone up in the ranks and
mm-hmm.
Is appointed, you know, we hear about, or is appointed by their level of service and length of tenure, as opposed to what people are sort of used to, which is ambassadors being appointed to France and
right.
Ireland and other
right.
maybe a little bit more exciting countries because of their influence. So you know, there, you know, I guess what I'm getting at is that there's a lot of prestige within you know, being at the State Department anyway. So, you know, in terms of your career, what sort of led to the State Department, and how hard was it for you to decide to leave? I mean, was there a transition period? Tell us a little bit about your journey.
So I have, journey-wise, I've bounced between government and nonprofit jobs since I graduated from Georgetown, and done everything from worked with my governor to worked in the White House with President Clinton, and then after that went to the nonprofit sector at Ashoka, and then to State Department. I had two different jobs with State Department. They were both contracts, and one of them was in the 90s. I went with State Department to work in Bosnia for a little while, organizing election work. And that was a short-term experience, but one that definitely profoundly affected me and shaped my worldview. And then later, went on another contract with State Department on the human trafficking portfolio in India. The reason why I went the second time back to State was because my wife had entered the Foreign Service, and while I thought I would have more of a domestic career, I then promptly fell in love with a wonderful woman who wanted to move overseas. So we moved to India, and, you know, both began our State Department careers. I think that it, in some ways, it was a difficult transition, because it's true, like, you know, you get comfortable in life. Many of us, if we're lucky enough, achieve some level of comfort. I mean, and not even necessarily, you know, hugely financially, but just comfortable where you are. You have enough to take care of yourself. You have no big concerns, and you have a job that's rewarding. And certainly, State Department, Foreign Service is exactly like that. But I wanted to do more. I knew that there was this opportunity. It seemed to me that there was this incredible, not just organization, not just network, but global movement that could exist. And not only that, huge challenges, not just today, as big as they are, but on the horizon, that we needed to start developing solutions for those challenges today. And so State Department basically told me I could leave for 2 years and still come back, and my wife had a perfectly secure job, and I thought I'd give it a try. We don't have kids yet, so
mm-hmm.
That was 4 years ago when I left. So that ship has sailed, and I'm down the creek or up the river, depending on how you look at it. But I had a lot of support from a lot of friends and family who believed in the idea, who believed in me, and even more importantly, believed in this concept that there are leaders all over the world who could contribute. Just another basic concept I want to share is that one of the things that I learned living around the world was that while opportunity is not evenly distributed in the world, you know, opportunity is actually highly concentrated in the United States, highly concentrated in cities, often highly concentrated in a handful of universities or corporations. Opportunity is not evenly distributed, but talent and good ideas and inspiring people are evenly distributed. No matter where you go in the world, no matter what village you're in, no matter what city you go to, no matter what country you're at, no matter what airport you're traveling through, you're coming across incredibly talented, inspiring, amazing people in both the for-profit, government, and nonprofit sectors. But the opportunity to act on those skills, to act on that talent, to do something with that ambition and inspiration is not evenly distributed. So that person who has the answer for HIV/AIDS, who has the answer in how best to empower women, could easily be stuck in a community, in a country, in an organization where he or she will never have the opportunity to cross borders and grow her own skills and also share her knowledge. And that just seemed like a travesty. And so,
yeah, and I
had to do it.
very exciting that you've been kind of at the right place at the right time with a very cool concept. And I know that other government organizations, including the Peace Corps, have partnered with you in some way or helped fund these efforts. And I think that's important to note because it goes beyond just, you know, having an affinity for one another, but they're actually endorsing you financially. So I think let's talk a little bit about those sort of high-level, levels of financial commitment that either the government or the private sector have made through the organization.
So we have this unique financial model where almost 75% of our money comes from the host, but we still need to raise the other 10%, and that, of course, adds up. So I've always had a priority of having diverse funding base, not just from income stream, but also from various sources. So in our first few years, we've had government, other nonprofits, foundations, individuals, and even corporations contributing, and a wide variety of corporations, including DuPont and Chevron and Pepsi and Chase Bank, have all supported our work. We've had foundations from the Case Foundation to Humanity United and the Midyar Network who have come in and contributed as well, and over 2,500 individuals. And on the government side, in fact, our first government funding came from the Colombian government. After we left India, we moved to Bogota, Colombia for 2 years, where my wife served in the embassy. And it was a really interesting meeting. They had heard about the program, were excited about it. I came in. I don't really have very strong Spanish. I made the mistake of asking, would you prefer this presentation be done in Spanish or English? They, of course, said Spanish, even though I knew they were fluent in English. So I had to present Atlas Corps in Spanish, which was a very difficult experience. And luckily, I had a Colombian there with me who was able to answer questions and advance it. And the Colombian government signed on in the second year and has supported us since in sending Colombians to the U.S. and, in fact, also in bringing Americans to Colombia. It's the one country where we have a two-way exchange. With the U.S. government, it was a little bit more difficult, despite having worked at the White House and having worked at the State Department.
Probably tells you more about the difficulty, really, actually.
You know, I think there's a fear about supporting new organizations, and that, frankly, starting a nonprofit can be very hard. So a lot of supporters will wait till you get beyond your third or fourth year. And
right. And
while I don't 100% agree with that, I do understand it, and so be it. But now we have we are working directly with the Peace Corps, which is very exciting, and they are supporting us to bring on two Atlas Corps fellows from around the world, not around the world, one from Latin America and one from Africa, to come to Peace Corps headquarters and to serve for a year at Peace Corps, which is going to be a great placement. That Peace Corps partnership, in addition to the Brookings Institution recently naming us a best practice international exchange, are helping us with the increased legitimacy for what is still a very reasonably young organization. But because of those partnerships, we're now launching a new campaign called 50 in the 50th. And this I'm very excited about. So we are going to bring 50 Atlas Corps fellows from around the world to volunteer in the United States in the 50th anniversary of the Peace Corps. And as you well
very
know,
cool.
this date's approaching. It was October 1950 when candidate Kennedy gave the speech at the University of Michigan announcing the idea of the Peace Corps. And in early 1951, when the Peace Corps was signed into law for the first fellows, all those series of events that come in the 50th anniversary and the start of the organization. So for us, for Atlas Corps in 2011, we're going to bring 50 leaders from all over the world to Washington, D.C., Baltimore, New York City to volunteer for 1 year. Frankly, in some ways, a small step. And it's almost crazy that it's taking this long to even get to this step. But showing that the U.S. can learn from countries and serve together, and showing that if we continually view the developing world, what sometimes people will still call the third world, but the developing world as a recipient for aid, rather than a partner in development, then we'll never overcome the global challenges that we have. We will never be able to tackle it. When you see people as folks who just need help, as opposed to individuals who, one, can help themselves, and two, can also help others, then we'll never make the progress that we need to make. And you can see it in the way development's been led over the last 50 years.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say I should give some credit to the early Peace Corps visionaries, though. Senator Harris Wofford, who's one of the architects of the Peace Corps, with Sergeant Shriver, when they were traveling overseas, they came along, I think it might have been the president of Nigeria, although Harris Wofford may kill me if he hears this because I don't remember which country it was. But the president of Nigeria said, he's like, okay, I like the idea of the Peace Corps. We'll take your volunteers. But what about African-educated men? What about African-educated men going to volunteer in the United States? 1961. So Sergeant Shriver said, who had been the head of the Chicago Public School District, if you have African-educated men ready for this program, we will bring them to the United States as well. And in the first 2 years of the Peace Corps, there was a Volunteers to America component where there were Africans and Indians, I believe some people from Latin America, who came to the U.S. But 2 years later, a congressman, I believe it was a congressman from West Virginia, found out about this program and got on the floor of the House and said, we have enough anarchists in the nonprofit sector in my own state that we don't need to import anarchists from other countries. And, the Congress ended the program. And for now 47 years, Harris Wofford has been looking for another program to support. And he joined our senior advisory board because he believes in the work, the idea of two-way service.
And I believe he was in Ethiopia, actually.
Harris started in the White House and started with Sergeant Shriver there in D.C. and then became the first Ethiopian country director.
Yes, very, very exciting. This country director roles have an incredible amount of power for those that don't know outside of the Peace Corps. I wanted to get back to something that I think that people that have come in and out of, and I think it was interesting that you noted there's this difference between the developing world and the third world, because I know that as someone who served in Turkmenistan, we called it the second world, because there was such an awareness when we would get together with volunteers from countries like Africa who were, still building, water, basic water supply systems, things, very, very, basic items, in the sort of, necessary layer of foundation in Maslow's hierarchy, if you go back to
right.
that. But those sort of things were kind of in place in places like Turkmenistan. A lot of the what we call the stands from the Soviet, being part of the Soviet Union, but they got left behind in a sense in terms of, having full education or being caught in cultural battles over language, effectively leaving generations, illiterate of their own language or the language of their country. So I think that's certainly its own issue. But one thing that you notice is, we had health volunteers in my program. I was a teacher, an English teacher there in Turkmenistan, and we had health programs. We had, as I mentioned, business programs. One of the things I think is fascinating is they talk about, and I'll talk a little bit about this, and I'll explain why in a second, but, one of the things that is actually harder than going to the countries, and people associate, as you said, sort of the things that we get comfortable with, losing those things. And I was working in a local television news station, and I remember they listed the things that I could not expect when I joined the Peace Corps. So, safe running tap water, heat and electricity, things like that, that are very serious. I mean, you really can't depend on those things. So, you really understand the level of commitment that you're making. But when you come back, they call it reverse culture shock. You actually have almost a harder time assimilating. I certainly did coming back. And one of my first experiences that really illuminated this, and nothing against Starbucks, they actually do really good work in local communities. But, with Starbucks, I remember coming back and seeing, I just wanted something to drink when I got back to, I think it was at LAX or something. And I remember looking at the price of coffee, and back then it was around $3 for a coffee, and now it's risen to a little bit over $5, it seems like, at least there in California. And I was just appalled because I could so clearly relate to what, that $3 would mean to my host family, who I had just left. And it was a really painful. It was very painful for me to see. I don't know any other way to sort of describe it. And the reason I say this is because I want to talk a little bit about what the experience is like for your individuals and the kind of support how the program really works, because it seems to me that, you know, sort of coming to this country, I'm sure a lot of folks would assume people don't want to go back to their country, but they actually do. So I was kind of curious about the fellows themselves and, you know, some of the potential concerns or issues that you've had to work into the program so that they're actually comfortable enough to learn both or share when they get back to their home country or transitioning into this one.
Sure. There's definitely a lot there. The whole reverse culture shock and culture shock are big things no matter which direction you're headed. And our fellows face it too. Our fellows are coming on a volunteer experience, so we provide them really just the basics. They're getting more than an AmeriCorps VISTA might, and certainly more than a Peace Corps volunteer would. But really, we're just covering their housing, their food, their transportation. So there, we have a phrase like it's not summer camp. Like, this is not a vacation. This is an opportunity to learn and to work hard. But we try to provide them enough financial, but also emotional and logistical support to make them feel comfortable in the United States and to, you know, be ready to be meaningful contributing members of their host organization. One thing the State Department does, for example, when you travel overseas, is they'll connect you with a social sponsor and a work sponsor or office sponsor. So the first day you arrive in the country, you literally have two quote-unquote friends who are pretty much always other people within the embassy community, and someone in your office and another perhaps couple that might be of the same age or kind of stage of life, whatever it may be. And we try to do similar things with our Atlas Corps fellows. We have work sponsors and social sponsors for our fellows. We have a very rich community in both D.C. and New York that we call our D.C. Friends of Atlas Corps and the New York Friends of Atlas Corps that do everything from take the fellows to the first time to the grocery store to show them, you know, where are the expensive grocery stores and where are the less expensive ones. Where can you get Indian spices and where can you get halal food for our Muslim fellows from Pakistan or other countries. And that support network is such a big part of living overseas, that the sense of community, the sense of family, the sense of not being alone, while it's such an American value to be so individualistic and to take care of yourself, and that people won't often help unless they're asked. I mean, it's just, will help immensely when asked, but won't necessarily, will generally give people their space. So we make sure that our fellows don't have too much space, that we are supporting them, and we don't want them to have too much space. We want them to be part of a rich community. We have a couple houses in D.C., actually three, where our fellows live. And it's pretty awesome to see the nonprofit leader from Zimbabwe and Belgium and Brazil and Colombia all living in the same house together. You know, the Muslim woman from Pakistan and the really very almost evangelical but Christian fellow from Nigeria who are best friends, who are living in the same house and spend so much time together. So we really try to make them have enough support so that when they're here they can really learn and contribute, and then help give them the skills, everything from the blogging and social media to even public speaking. So when they go back to their country, they have the technical know-how to translate those skills back at home. But also even the cultural expectations. We bring in this incredible professor, a guy named Gary Weaver, who teaches cultural orientation for, in fact, the Peace Corps. Maybe you had him. Peace Corps and the Diplomatic Corps and the Marine Corps. And he does cultural orientation for Atlas Corps as well. And he's one of our best speakers all year. And then we bring him back at the end to do a session on reverse culture shock, and which my wife will often join because we move so often that it's kind of helpful to get refresher lessons on what to expect and how to deal with it. It's a universal experience that people have.
Absolutely. So what are some of the tenets of what they're taught to expect when they go back, and have there been any specific cases, no need to name regions or anything, but, you know, things that you've learned from in terms of the process, or you feel like you kind of started and were able to go with the right process? Because, I mean, obviously you have a very rich experience yourself in your life of what you know, individuals, what your individual fellows might need.
Yeah, we're definitely a learning organization, and I'm certainly not, you know, all-knowing. We've had to evolve our program with each year. I would say we're very lucky, if not blessed, in having really great fellows in our program. It's an exceptionally competitive program. We have about a 1% acceptance rate, literally about 100 candidates for every one position that we fill. So we get incredible people, which makes the process a little bit easier. That being said, our first year, we were doing trainings about once a month and doing these three-hour trainings, and our fellows were like, we simply want more. So we've changed it to an all-day training session the last Friday of every month. Host organizations are happy with it too because they're getting more skills, but it gives more opportunity for the fellows to come together. In the beginning we just had Gary Weaver come twice, but then we've moved it up to twice because we found greater value in it. We started out with just Indians and Colombians because we started with just two countries, but by our second year we decided to open it up to anybody from anywhere in the world, and it was a huge successful expansion because we're able to bring in so many different perspectives. It wasn't just country A and country B and people being in their own groups, but you can't create a group when you have 39 people from 12 different countries because there's just so many different diverse perspectives. And
mm-hmm.
you know, so you're more likely to really embrace the notion of integrating. All of our fellows have gone home. Mentioning one other note you mentioned before. When I started the program, mm-hmm. people said, oh, people are going to come here and they're going to want to stay forever because that's what people do when they come to the U.S. And it's just such a myopic view. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It's a misconception. I mean, for one thing, many of these people have very good lives back at home. Some are wealthy, some are poor, but many of them have great support networks and often very good jobs. They're obviously successful individuals. They all come from very strong academic backgrounds. And they generally live very comfortable lives with rich meaning and big support networks. So most of them don't want to start from zero, from scratch in the U.S., to do it in some way illegally. I mean, they're required to go back in this program. So we're very happy that all of our fellows have gone back. We have had a couple fellows who have ended the program early, either because it might have been a bad pick on our part or a bad decision on their part. But it's been, I guess, three fellows of the 39, so we're content with that percentage,
yeah,
exactly. So we're still learning with each year, and we're also learning and managing people's expectations. You know, we have a misconceived perception of what it means to be from Africa, what it means to be from India, but often they'll have a misperception of what it means to live in the United States. So we're doing more things to prepare our fellows for the notion that you will, in fact, be volunteering. You will, in fact, you know, not be able to go out to restaurants and, you know, fly to Hollywood and when you're living in D.C. And those things can be upsetting. It's like, I came all the way to D.C. I want to be able to, you know, see this country. And I'm like, this country's huge. We're going to take you to New York. We'll take you to Richmond. We'll go on some retreats. We can't pay them a salary that would allow them to travel all over the country. Most nonprofits don't even pay Americans those salaries.
Absolutely, I was just going to say.
So, you know, there's been sacrifices and expectations that have been a part of it, but I think one of the things we've learned also is that we have to let people know it's going to be a difficult experience. That's why we say it's not summer camp. And sometimes they'll be frustrated, just like a Peace Corps volunteer, or just like an AmeriCorps VISTA, or even a U.S. diplomat serving overseas. Working often in a different language, in a different environment, things are just usually more difficult. Sometimes I'll even compare it to like running in water, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
But when you get out of the water, when you get back in your environment, you're just so much stronger, you're so much quicker, you're so much, The Economist did an article recently that said, living overseas makes you more creative. Living
it definitely
overseas
does.
Makes you more creative. That's brilliant. Like, who doesn't want to be more creative in their life, no matter what sector you're in? So they go
and
back.
And also that can go for innovation as well. Mm-hmm. I think that's
oh, 100%.
A big piece of it. You know, people forget that, you know, business innovation is something that the U.S. needs to cultivate. And, you know, the learnings that we can get from other countries, I think, actually helps create better organizations, whether they be nonprofit or for-profit organizations.
And just the new way of looking at things. Our tagline is change your perspective, change the world. And I'll sometimes give the example of anybody who plays chess. Like, you can be playing chess and be really good at chess and think you know all the moves. And occasionally, if you turn the chessboard around and look at it from the other side, you realize that the other person's playing an entirely different game on the same board.
Mm-hmm.
And it's rare that we get that perspective in life to be able to literally look at something from the other perspective. And living overseas, especially serving overseas, gives us that opportunity. And just go back a little bit when you're talking about developing world or third world or second world. These terms are just so far off. And they're so, if they ever had meaning, they don't anymore. Because
yeah, that's why we were so frustrated by the term. We created our own. I'm sure other people had come up with it as well. I think it was something that often Peace Corps volunteers have other friends that volunteer together, and you're not promised placement together unless you're married, of course. One of my good friends that I roomed with during training had a friend that was in Jamaica, and so they were exchanging letters, and that was a term that I think arose out of those conversations. But yeah, certainly it's very difficult. Nomenclature can, you know, really get in the way, and it can be a little frustrating in and of itself. Just calling things the right name, is so key.
Yeah, historically speaking, Second World often referred to the communist world when kind of the initial book was written, First World, Second World, Third World. But a lot of nonprofit leaders especially use the term Global South, whether they're in the South or not. I like the term Global South a little bit more too. But even that term is totally irrelevant, because if you're a rich person who lives in Brazil or Colombia or Argentina or Mexico, and you compare it to like a poor person living in Greece or the United States or any number of other countries, like those terms, no country is a monolith anymore. So when we view India as a poor country, we are missing the incredible wealth that exists within that country. When we view the United States as a rich country, we're turning a blind eye to the immense poverty we have in our own backyard. Same thing with HIV/AIDS. When we see Africa as a continent that is entirely devastated by HIV/AIDS, I mean, there's some truth in that. But to say that every country has had the exact same rates or the exact same issues, and not realize within some of our own cities the same challenges, it's not just a shame. It actually has negative consequences, where it affects policy, it affects development, it affects people's individual actions. So we just need to reject those terms as much as possible. So much so that we have Global North people in our program. Not only do we send Americans abroad, but we have a Belgian volunteering in the United States. We eventually see a world where the most talented people will go to the best organizations, crossing borders, sharing ideas, regardless of what direction you send it in. This year we have a candidate from Mexico who's applying to volunteer in D.C. and is also applying to be an Atlas Corps Fellow in Bogota. I love it. I love it. It just shows, it's like, this is a person who has skills and talent, wants to go overseas and make a difference, and it does not matter to her whether it's Bogota, Colombia, D.C., or New York. She wants to make a difference and learn and bring those skills back to her community.
That's fantastic. That is such a great, great example. And I think what you said about, I could not concur more that, if you are living and the gentrification happens all over the world. And, anyone can go to, for example, New Delhi and have a 5-star luxury experience, but it's certainly not the same. And when I see shows, Gordon Ramsay's doing a series right now on Indian cooking. And initially I was very, very skeptical. My husband's like, wait, give it a second. I think it'll appeal to you. And he actually went out into villages and, was tasting things from this very specific southern region and didn't realize that it was ants and ant eggs that made up the flavor of the chutney that he was eating.
Wow.
And he was open to it. You know, you have to be open to it, or it's not going to work. And you know, I think the interesting thing is, you know, we talk about, you know, gaining language skills. I think it's been adopted more and more by the best schools. I don't want to make too many assumptions, but I know certainly I was lucky enough to attend universities and even high schools where, you know, knowing that immersion in a language or in a culture is the most effective way to learn. Mm-hmm. And I know that one of the challenges, for example, our health volunteers had in the Peace Corps, and this has been several years now, but, you know, I keep in touch, obviously, with the volunteers that are going abroad now and now are able to catalog what they're doing online, so I'm able to follow that a lot more closely. But things like my host mother insisting that I not sit on concrete because it would make me sterile as a woman. I wouldn't be able to have children. I actually started collecting what I called, you know, folk stories or folk tales at the time.
Right.
That were, you know, common conceptions from health to education to business, the three main areas of our core. And so when I would come back together with volunteers, usually around American holidays like Thanksgiving, and we'd have the, you know, we were able to find a way to be together to celebrate that, you know, we would exchange stories, and so I would document them. And I think that's a big piece of bringing volunteers here, though it's not been, you know, it's definitely not been until it sounds like really your organization has come along, the Peace Corps, unless I'm mistaken, or really any organization. So I guess this is getting me to the place of asking about other organizations that do similar work to yours or maybe even the same work that you do and maybe how it differs. And really what you're looking to, you know, even more specifically, what you're looking to accomplish, because I do see it as sort of this, you know, immersion technique for the very motivated, because, and I'll ask you in a minute about the application process for the fellows that come here, but, you know, I think it would be interesting for people to have perspective about who is, what other organizations are potentially doing this?
Mm-hmm.
I just think it would be incredibly effective to bring people here to learn about how to run a successful nonprofit.
Sure, there are a handful of education programs. So if you're a nonprofit leader from any country in the world, you could apply to get a master's in the United States. So there are probably actually tons of education programs, but I do mm-hmm. fundamentally believe that's different. And the education sector is doing great work in here in this area, but it is a different experience than volunteering, of course. There are a handful of organizations that do short-term exchanges. So they might bring someone over for 2 or 3 weeks. I mean, there could even be a dozen organizations that do that, from Meridian being one of the best, to Partners for the Americas will do it with people in Latin America. So there are a lot of really good programs doing short-term exchanges, often funded by the U.S. government, that have great value and are very good programs. When it comes to long-term fellowships, a year, 18 months, even for that matter, over 6 months, there's very, very few people in this space. World Leadership Corps is an organization that used to do it, and we're working really closely with them in New York. And Global Health Corps is an organization that has brought a couple health leaders from Africa to the U.S., and we're working very, very closely with them as well. And both those organizations are fantastic. I don't think there are a lot of other organizations in the space. There's an Earth. Oh my, now I'm blank. It's like Earth Corps. Now I'm really embarrassed. I can't remember the name of it. In Seattle, they've brought over. Usually younger environmental leaders, usually for about 6 months, they do some very good work too. And we try to, as much as possible, partner with all these organizations because we do fundamentally believe in the larger mission or vision, to get to your second question, which is that ultimately our goal is to, you know, develop leaders, strengthen organizations, and promote innovation in the global nonprofit sector through this overseas fellowship. And what we're really trying to accomplish is we're trying to strengthen the leaders who are going to help solve the world's problems. Just another sort of quick story here. One thing I learned in living in Colombia and living in India and in Bosnia and some other countries is it's really shocking how well organized and networked the villains of the world are.
That's so true.
You know, and I don't mean like James Bond, like Austin Powers sitting around a table, like sort of conniving in that way.
Plotting, yeah.
But at the same time, like people, like villains will literally cross borders and learn skills about how to make bombs or do terrorism or, you know, literally terrorism went from like Sri Lanka to Palestine. I mean, like Sri Lanka to Palestine, like just crazy, like suicide bombers, just amazing ways that villains cooperate across borders. And when I had this thought, it occurred to myself, I think the heroes of the world, I think the people doing the most inspiring things to address the most critical issues should be at least as well networked as the villains. Maybe you could even argue better networked. And there's not that type of network, and there's not that type of global collaboration, cooperation, network support. Even the private sector, you've got some business schools that everyone went to. I mean, heck, even the government sector in D.C., a lot of people have gone to the Kennedy School of Government. They all know each other. But in the nonprofit sector, and even the U.S. peace nonprofit sector, the whole Return Peace Corps volunteer network and the AmeriCorps network really do support a lot of people. But overseas...
Absolutely. I'd say the AmeriCorps network actually is, just to chime in, because I was an AmeriCorps volunteer in its very first year, it's improved immensely. It had really little to no support at the beginning, and it's really started to recognize the need, and I think the Peace Corps is a great model, the return model of really connecting people has been, you know, a very helpful experience. And as you said earlier, you know, you get, as part of the Peace Corps, you get a what we call counterpart, and you know, and then you have a host family, so you have sort of this base. So people need that, I think, to hold on to.
Absolutely. So our larger vision is to have 5,000 fellows a year and, you know, 20,000 alumni who are working on these issues, so that when you have talks like you did a few months back between China and the U.S. and countries around the world talking about reducing emissions, people in that room may be bilingual and some of them may be bicultural, understanding each other's perspectives, but there are very few people in that room who have a common shared experience of serving, of giving back, of the mutual respect that's gained, that's achieved by serving together. And that is what we're really trying to achieve. So the leadership is very important, the service is critical, but this larger goal, this global network, is really our secret mission, if you will, our secret goal of creating the social capital, creating these connections all around the world.
Absolutely, and I think it's so incredibly warranted, if that's the right phrase. It's just really, really needed. And I think it's interesting, you know, I mean, it's important, I think, that we point out that you're, you know, certified as one of the best in America or best in America by the Independent Charities of America. So, I mean, there's definitely recognition here at home that helps, I think, get the word out. I do want to make sure that we address a little bit about, you know, what it's like for these volunteers, or fellows, I'm sorry, to apply, and how they, it may even be, I'm not sure, but I'd like to know if it's, and I'm sure the audience would as well, you know, what the experience is like for them. Is it difficult? You know, sometimes there's no access to, you know, the things we think of as being, you know, central to applying to schools. You know, I can't even imagine being in Turkmenistan and trying to do my Columbia graduate school journalism. the major writing that went into that. So you know, I can imagine there's, you know, sort of similar need to explain, you know, yourself and the reasons and the opportunity and what you can bring to the table. So describe a little bit, if you could, both the application process, because you were talking about the 1% acceptance rate, as well as, you know, how volunteers have been able to, or what challenges they may face and how maybe they've overcome them to be able to really bring you the best applications possible.
Yeah, great question. So our application process is entirely online. It's atlascorps.org. And that's true for Americans who want to serve in Bogota, Colombia as well. And we have a basic requirements of 3 years of experience, generally in the nonprofit sector, college degree, and English fluency. And generally our fellows range from about 24 years old to 34 years old, with our average fellow being a 29-year-old woman from the Global South who has a master's degree. Of our 39 fellows, about 90% of them have been women, which is a whole fascinating different radio show. But to get to the question, so as long as you have online access, the technological side of things is not really that difficult. And most of the people that we're dealing with, the education level we're dealing with, often are in jobs and are very often in cities, and they're able to get online. So technologically, it's not that difficult. They put in their passport number, all their details. They download essay questions. They have to get 2 reference letters. I do think procedurally wise, it can be difficult because how someone from overseas will, you know, show their resume and how an American might show their resume, or even just other countries around the world, varies a great deal. I remember the first year being surprised how many people from India included their picture. In the United States, you almost never include your picture on a resume. Or like even like the name of your father. I think it's like, you know, son of this person as like an identifying factor. You know, proud son of my parents, but I haven't put it on my resume. There is an issue about how they articulate, how they answer the questions, and how they prioritize their resumes and format it. And we have like an online video on YouTube that shows people like what's a strong application, basically. So people can, if they, again, have access to online, they can watch a video and learn how best to do it. We definitely get a lot of applications that just are not that great, but we have so many applications that come in. I think we had like 1,600 applications for our last 16 positions, and that we can really very quickly narrow in on the top applications. And so if it's harsh, but if people don't follow the application rules or processes, they're very often not given great consideration. It's kind of a basic tenement. If you're going to be a nonprofit leader who's going to change the world, then we expect you to basically follow the directions. And there are enough people out there who are doing it. We will then give those top candidates, we'll read their applications. We have volunteers read applications. If people out there want to volunteer to read applications, we always need volunteers because we have hundreds of applications. And people read applications, they score them, we score them. We then focus on the top numbers. We give those people an English test. We do a video Skype interview with them so we can see them face-to-face over a camera and talk to them about the experience and make sure they know what they're getting into. And then the host organization, the Grameen Foundation, will then interview their organizations, their fellows, and decide who they ultimately want. So it's just a very competitive, rigorous process. Then we spend about 4 months doing it, accept a class of fellows, go 2 months, and then do it again another 4 months for another class of fellows. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, so in evaluate, you identified a need for people to help with the application process and reviewing applications. Are you looking for nonprofits to be helping with this, or are you looking for basically individuals with skill sets, particular skill sets to be helping you go through them and score them?
I mean, really, almost any. We actually have readers from around the world who help volunteer. Again, we take volunteers from all over. It's almost all online. We will email you applications, give you a score sheet and directions. I even have a video to give scores about what makes a good application. And, you know, we want, generally, most people have English as their first language, although if you're fluent in English and it's your second language, that would be fine too. And you don't have to be a nonprofit person. I mean, it helps to have sort of some knowledge of the nonprofit sector. It helps to have some perspectives of the world. But this also could be a way to learn more about the nonprofit sector and learn more about the world. It's usually about a 3-hour volunteer commitment. You're reading 6 applications, and you're sending in scores. The info@atlascorps.org is one of the best ways to contact, or just go to atlascorps.org and get more information, and you can sign up to be a reader or a volunteer. We are looking for nonprofit organizations who want to be host organizations, so especially in D.C., Baltimore, New York. If your organization thinks that they could benefit from skills overseas and thinks they could swing the cost share, then let's have a conversation. And on the Partners tab of our website, it talks more about how nonprofits become partners. And there are even people who just become sponsors. Maybe someone who wants to sponsor a week of the fellowship. Even a $100 donation will help sponsor a training day for a fellow. Or even a $10 donation helps get involved to become part of this large global movement. We have over 2,500 people who have donated to Atlas Corps, the average donation being about $35. So a lot of people have said, I want to be a part of this. Another realization that I had a number of years ago was that there were so many problems in the world that I did not know how to fix. I did not know how to fix global warming. I did not know how to fix HIV/AIDS. I did not know how to empower women. I was frustrated by my inability of how to solve the world's problems. But what I had realized and what I knew at the time was that other people had the ideas and other people had the solutions. So what I could do, and I think what we all can do, is help provide those opportunities for those folks, be it as a volunteer or a supporter, as a host organization, or yourself as an Atlas Corps fellow. All of us can chip in some way, and that's the only way we're going to be able to solve these world's challenges.
Absolutely, and I just want to let folks know that are listening that I happen to be on Causes on Facebook, so it's so simple to donate to Atlas Corps. You can simply add it as one of your causes. More than $42,000 has already been donated through causes, mm-hmm. Which is largely driven by Facebook these days. Even though it's an independent website as well. But I think, that's a super easy way. Most people are on Facebook. And if you, cruise on over to, the Atlas Corps page, you can certainly like the organization and donate whatever you can to help the effort. I think that's so key. And donating time to review applications, it's not as daunting as people think it sounds like. And you definitely have a great on YouTube. And if you go to the Atlas Corps .org homepage, the links to their social networks are right there, so you can get to places where, for example, the YouTube channel that has a wealth of videos.
Yeah, we make it easy for everyone. It's youtube.com/AtlasCorps, facebook.com/AtlasCorps, causes.com/AtlasCorps, and it's just ATLASCORPS. So it's as long as you get the S at the end of Atlas Corps, they'll be able to find it.
Yes. So tell us about how you came up with the name.
It was a brainstorming session with some of the most inspiring people I've met in India. We wanted a name that would work well on a good website. We wanted a name that would work well in multiple different languages. We wanted a name that gave a shout-out to organizations like Peace Corps and AmeriCorps that we believe in so much. And ultimately chose Atlas Corps because it achieved all those goals. And the imagery of Atlas holding the globe on his shoulders, or even two, the imagery of our logo, which is an upside-down world, and reinforcing this message of saying, let's view the world in a different way, let's change our perspectives, and then from there, we can begin to make some real significant changes. So it was a long process. I hope naming a kid is going to be easier than the name of this organization, because we spent a lot of time on it, but... we're probably won't be easier with the kid, it was a fun process.
So, are there any? And this is, I think, fascinating, especially if you've done work at international organizations. If you haven't, it's really interesting. But have you encountered any, or were there any names, I guess, that you could have named the organization that would have potentially been offensive?
Oh, gosh, I'm sure. That's just one of the things that work in finding a name that would work in every different language is so hard. Because,
oh, it is.
I met this guy who worked, I think it was maybe even an oil company, if you can believe it, or maybe a coal mining company called Ashanti. And I thought mm-hmm. that was an Indian word, an Hindi word. And he's like, no, we actually have African roots. But I asked my wife, who speaks Hindi, and Shanti, I believe, means peace in Hindi, and A before a word often means like the absence of or without. So, like this company in Africa, is if you said it in Hindi, basically means like the absence of peace, which is not any company would want to be named the absence of peace.
Hopefully not.
The nice thing about Greek and Roman mythology, while it's got some of its own baggage associated with it, is for the most part those words have cut across many different languages. So Atlas may not mean a book of maps in another language, but it's not going to mean much other things. It's going to, one way or another, refer back to like the Greek god of Atlas. We've gotten pretty lucky with how we've named the organization.
Well, that's fantastic. And Scott Beal, who is the CEO and founder of Atlas Core with a PS at the end, we thank you for your time. I will make sure that we get a blog post up and we link everywhere to you. I appreciate you taking time to share about the organization with our listeners and hope you get some good response.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity.
And great job with all that you've accomplished.
Yeah, it's been a huge collaborative effort. So we're quite pleased with the way everything's gone.
Fantastic. Thanks, Scott, for joining us today.
Take care.
And I want to thank you too. And I want to thank you, the listener, for tuning into the A-List with me, Jennifer Lindsay. If you like this show, please add us to your favorites or friend us here on Blog Talk Radio or rate us on iTunes. Be sure to tune in next week at 12 noon Pacific. And as always, you can keep up with the latest at jenniferlindsay.com. Have a fabulous weekend.